Hello and welcome back to the Turkey Book Talk podcast, and a very happy new year to you. My name's William Armstrong, and in this podcast I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. For the first podcast of the year, I spoke to the novelist Kaya Genç, the editor of a brand new selection of classic writing about Istanbul from great names like Herman Melville, Ernest Hemingway, and Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. The book is called An Istanbul Anthology, and it's published as part of a series by the American University in Cairo Press. I started by asking Kaya Genç about some of the continuities or recurring themes that visitors have observed about Istanbul over the years.
Well, there's this big interest in Istanbul, and of course the historical monuments in Istanbul, and there's this kind of feeling of mystery that there's a wheel over Istanbul, and the foreign traveler will go beneath that wheel and, you know, discover something mysterious. So there's a sense of discovery in most of these writings, and many of them are produced by men, and the one by Arthur Conan Doyle. So there's like a Sherlockian quality to it, this kind of power. And how it fascinates the Western observer is, I think, a continuing theme in many of these writings. But of course, I picked some writings from 17th century. There's one from 16th century. So the concerns are very different. And as the ages change, the observer's point of view changes. 19th century is the great age of Orientalism, and where all the information about the Orient becomes something else entirely. It becomes something much more powerful and politically important. But when you look at earlier writings, when you look at someone who wrote in, let's say, 17th century, the writing looks more innocent in a way. But then there is a great escalation of the number of travelers towards the late 19th century. And that's a period that I really like to write about and to explore academically. So it was fun and really interesting to read the decadent writers visiting Istanbul in 1870s, 1890s, and how their observations were different from those written in 18th century or 17th century.
I'd never actually read the Conan Doyle writings on Istanbul before, so that was good to get a handle on those.
Yeah, it's. There's this great story waiting to be told about Arthur Conan Doyle's relationship with Sultan Abdülhamit, and the quote I used in the book gives us some insight to it. He was here in 1907, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Sultan Abdülhamit was a big fan of his fiction.
Yeah,
he didn't like his historical novels that much. He was a fan. He was a Sherlockian. He was a proper Sherlockian. And I included this scene where he attends the weekly selamlık of Abdülhamit, and he saws him. He sees him there, and his fascination with the whole thing. And of course, Sultan Abdülhamit was very suspicious of foreigners. That's something we see a lot in Ottoman statesmen. And so he had a spy on Arthur Conan Doyle. He was spying on him to see whether he was spying on him, on the Sultan. So their friendship, It's a very interesting relationship, and there is a little slice of it in the book. He was actually researching for a book that he wanted to write about Istanbul, and so when he visited Abdülhamit, he was taking notes, maybe mental notes, inside the palace and talking to people to learn about details about the Sultan's life. So that caused him. So that caused some trouble because Abdülhamit became suspicious. And so after that, Arthur Conan Doyle lost some of his privileges about saying Abdülhamid. But we know that when the Young Turk Revolution took place and people, all the rebels came and surrounded Abdülhamid's palace. It's rumored that he was reading aloud Arthur Conan Doyle's stories in order to remain calm and not hear what was going on outside. And he also get his stories translated into Turkish by his team of translators from the Translation Bureau. I would really like to see a Sherlock episode taking place in Istanbul next season.
It struck me as I was reading the book that the these writings on the Ottoman capital were often less revealing of the actual character of the city than of the author's interpretation of it. In many ways, it always seems that we're kind of reading about the authors themselves rather than about Istanbul itself.
Yes, totally. When you look at the character of the observer, someone like Ernest Hemingway, and how his temper is so different from someone like, you know, Mark Twain or, you know, Théophile Gautier, the way they approach their subjects, literally, the way they approach their subject stylistically is, of course, important. And their temperament is important because most of these writings are from diaries or newspaper articles. They're not from novels. So what we get is not their, let's say, fictional artistic styles, but more like their temperaments and how they find their reflection in those writers' writings. But Istanbul is used in a way as a canvas on which the writer, the observer, reflects his or her current mood. And so we get a, you know, very sad and melancholic Nerval, or a very alcohol-focused and entertainment-focused Hemingway, or a very good journalist, Gautier. You know, Gautier's writing is very precise and focused on detail, and you see that this is a hardworking writer, this is a hardworking correspondent trying to bring some detail from the city to readers in Paris. So I definitely agree that the city reveals more about the writers than it does about itself.
And at the very end, there's this, you have a very sort of depressed André Gide. The final section of the book is titled The City is Hell. And it's a funny way to finish such a collection. But I should say it really resonated as I struggled around Istanbul in the freezing cold, snowy sludge last week.
Yeah, I mean, hating Istanbul is, of course, a way of loving Istanbul. We all love to hate Istanbul. And I mean, of course, you don't expect Flaubert or Gide to write a love letter to Istanbul. You expect them to write angrily or nihilistically, as they often do in their other writings. And so when I proposed to include a chapter called The City as Hell, my editor was, yeah, that sounds great. Let's let's do it, because I mean, when Istanbul is seen as a hell, or when it's seen as something to hate about, it becomes another source of inspiration. And some writers get their inspiration from hating things. And that's what these French writers did.
Now, all the selections in the book are of American or European travelers. Was that a deliberate decision on your part, or was it by necessity demanded by the publisher?
This is a series of books from the AUC Press. They had a Alexandria anthology, a Cairo anthology, a Beirut anthology, and the format was to use European travelers. And so I couldn't, for example, use writers like, say, Evliya Çelebi or Eastern writers, you know, Egyptian writers. Actually, I was researching all these writers because I'm writing a history of Turkish literature. and I'm writing about how those writers see Turkey and Istanbul. But for this book, it had to be European and American writers, and my preferred language here was English, and I also picked writings before 1920s. So Hemingway is one of the last writers in this book. So all the books are in public domain, and they're mostly from Europe or England or America.
If you could have cast the net out wider and included some non-Western writers, who would you have included? Who would you give a tip to the listeners to go out and find?
I mean, for example, I'm really fascinated by this figure called Celaleddin El Afgani. This guy who I discovered through Pankaj Mishra's book about Asia from the ruins of the empire. It's a great book. It's about looking at what happened in the first half of the 20th century through the perspective of, let's say, the Eastern intellectuals by using their original writings, their diaries, their books, and seeing what went on from their perspective, from the perspective of the colonized, from those who were oppressed. And El Afgani was an interesting figure. He was invited to Istanbul by Sultan Abdülhamit, and he was an Islamist and a very angry one. And this very passionate writer was eventually disillusioned by Abdülhamit because he didn't find him militant enough, you know, angry enough. You know, he was like, you were in the pay of foreign countries, you're doing business with them. I want a big revolution. I want a big uprising under one caliph figure. And so he lived in Nishantashi, interestingly, now associated with the so-called White Turks and the secularists. And Abdülhamit gave him a place in Nishantashi, and he lived there for many years. And I was writing about Mehmet Akif Ersoy today for my book. And Mehmet Akif is also an Islamist figure, and he didn't like El Afgani. He found him too angry, maybe too passionate. And he wanted a sort of calm version of Islam. He preferred that. So it would be interesting to include something by El Afgani, you know, even though he's found problematic by these figures. It would be interesting because it would maybe be an interesting parallel to someone like Gustave Flaubert. You know, Flaubert was a angry guy. He was a very passionate guy. But then, of course, his passions were in more like about aesthetics and the art of the novel and, you know, the correct word to use in a sentence and composition. And the way the things he pays attention to would be interesting to see alongside someone like El Afgani, and to see what kind of things he pays attention to. And of course, it would be interesting to see Nishantashi from the perspective of a, you know, this proto-Islamist, and that would be interesting.
Yeah, I wonder what he'd say about it now. So now I'm going to ask you just to do something a bit different for the podcast and read out one of your favorite passages from the book. First of all, explain who wrote it and why you think it's particularly worth hearing.
I picked Mark Twain's writing about Istanbul dogs. I'm fascinated by Istanbul dogs and the way they don't make it into Turkish fiction. They're such a, you know, important part of the city's life, and you know, we become aware of them when they attack us, maybe, but in writing we don't see them very often. And it was interesting to see Mark Twain writing about dogs and discovering how they moved according to certain rules, and how there were groups among them, and how the dogs on Istiklal streets were different from dogs, let's say, in Karaköy. So that's why I picked this passage. Istanbul Dogs, 1867. The dogs sleep in the streets all over the city. From one end of the street to the other, I suppose they will average about 8 or 10 to a block. Sometimes, of course, there are 15 or 20 to a block. They do not belong to anybody, and they seem to have no close personal friendships among each other. But they district the city themselves, and the dogs of each district, whether it be half a block in extent or 10 blocks, have to remain within its bounds. Woe to a dog if he crosses the line. His neighbors would snatch the balance of his hair off in a second. So it is said, but they don't look it. They sleep in the streets these days. They are my compass, my guide. When I see the dogs sleep placidly on, while men, sheep, geese, and all moving things turn out and go around them, I know I'm not in the great street where the hotel is, and must go further. In the Grand Rue, the dogs have a sort of air of being on the lookout, an air born of being obliged to get out of the way of many carriages every day, and that expression one recognizes in a moment. It does not exist upon the face of any dog without the confines of that street. All others sleep placidly and keep no watch. They would not move, though the Sultan himself passed by. Yeah, so this is Mark Twain. I really enjoy his writing about Istanbul and his observations. He's also a journalist at heart, and his book, I think called Innocence Abroad.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite books, and I made the use of it in my own novel. I'm writing a novel about late 19th century Istanbul, and the way Mark Twain describes Istanbul, and you know, the world, even he describes the world of journalism and, you know, censorship, the kind of things he's interested in is of interest to me as well. And he came here in 1867, and his writing, I mean, that kind of passage, you know, seeing that some dogs on the, you know, Grand Rue and Istiklal move differently because they see these carriages all day long. You know, that's something you recognize as something true. And, you know, when you go to Istiklal and when you see dogs there, they have a different way of reacting to things, all that confusion on the street. And so what you really like is this kind of detail. But then maybe I can read something else by Théophile Gautier.
Yes.
Which is very different. But that's something I also like for other reasons. Not for the detail, but for the sort of poetic tone, if I can find it. Yes, it's in the very beginning of the book, and the chapter entitled The Sea and the Wheel. Oh, okay. So this is not by Théophile Gautier, but Edmondo de Amigis, sorry. it's from his book, Constantinople. It's from 1875. So it's a very fine piece of writing. At last came glimmering through the veil some whitish spots, then the vague outline of a great heat, then the scattered and vivid glitter of window panes shining in the sun, and finally Galata and Pera in full light, a mountain of many colored houses, one about the other, a lofty city crowned with minarets, cupolas, and cypresses. Upon the summit, the monumental palaces of the different embassies and the great tower of Galata. At the foot, the vast arsenal of Topane and a forest of ships. And as the fog receded, the city lengthened rapidly along the Bosphorus, and quarter after quarter started forth scratching from the hilltops down to the sea, vast, thickly sown with houses, and dotted with white mosques, rows of ships, little ports, palaces rising from the water, pavilions, gardens, kiosks, and groves, and dimly seen in the mist beyond, the sun-gilded summits of still other quarters, a glow of colors, an exuberance of verdure, a perspective of lovely views, a grandeur, a delight, a grace to call forth the wildest exclamations. And then he goes on to describe some mosques and Üsküdar, the hills of Üsküdar, and the Golden Horn. So it's kind of a, let's say, drone view of Istanbul. You know, you can imagine the narrators kind of flying on Istanbul and giving us the sort of aerial view, sort of a different, bigger, wider view. This kind of panoramic representations. Istanbul has inspired many writers to produce this kind of, you know, big sized paintings. And that's one of my favorites in the book.
That was Kaya Genç in conversation with me, William Armstrong. I do hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and I hope you appreciate this new higher quality microphone that I've got, which admittedly was much needed. Again, please do rate the podcast on iTunes, which helps spread the word and makes it easier for people to search for. If you haven't already, you can subscribe via iTunes, Podbean, or SoundCloud, and you can like the Turkey Book Talk podcast Facebook page. But until next time, thank you very much for listening.